Mr. Sykes, Reel 8. We're talking about your period in this barrack accommodation. Is there anything else you remember about that camp?
Well, since you were last here, the one thing I did remember is the name of the camp, which was Homs.
H-O-M-S.
H-O-M-S.
But anything else about the actual conditions that you lived under there?
Not really. Not what I told you the last time.
Where did you go from there, then?
From there, we went to another Italian barrack called Trigtahuna. And
whereabouts was that? Still
in? Still in North Africa. And there, it was Italian barracks, very similar to the ones that we'd had in Homs. Still sleeping on the floor and that kind of thing. Rations pretty much the same, tomato puree, rice, occasional bit of meat, occasional cheese ration, and the coal.
Were you losing weight at all?
Oh yes, we'd all lost quite a lot of weight, because we'd all been, although we'd been in the desert, we're all pretty fit, but obviously with the rations that we had, we were losing a bit of weight and all getting a bit ridgy and that kind of thing.
Any health problems?
The one thing that we did have was lice, and head lice, and to that end they removed all our hair. They took all our hair off in Trigtahuna, and they took it right off.
Did it take body hair off as well, or just your head?
No, just hair. It didn't take anybody's hair. Just your head hair, you know what I mean? Although you got lice in your body hair as well, when you're on through the legs and that kind of thing.
Was there any other method of, did you get anything else to try and stop the lice?
No, you just killed them. I mean, if you got a cigarette, you could pop the eggs. They used to accumulate in the sort of seams, your trousers or your shirts and all that. The funny part about it was that I don't think any of us had knew what a louse looked like till we were in prison camp. You know, and the obvious things they are, and the bite and all that. Later on, of course, we got the denounced, but not in this place.
And how long were you in Trigtahuna?
Well, I can't remember exactly, but I reckon we were there till about the end of November.
So quite a while in all.
Yeah, very small. We'd been from being picked up to then, which was picked up in June, and I reckon we left Trigtahuna about the end of November.
And what happened on the move?
Well, then we moved from there. And we went to Tripoli. We came to Tripoli. We didn't stay at Tripoli at all. We were embarked onto a ship at Tripoli and taken over to Naples. Now, probably the worst experience that I've ever had was, in fact, going over on that boat.
Why was that?
Because they gave us one biscuit, hard tack biscuit, one small tin of meat. We were put onto this boat, we were one deck down, and like below, and the roof on, if you like, so we were all in this darkness and semi darkness, a bit of light came through the holes, there's no lights or anything like that. So we were in there, and when we started off, the sea was very rough, so everybody was seasick and nowhere to go, you know.
No latrines?
Well, they had a latrine as such, but that was up a ladder, and it was like a board, you know, with holes in, and it more or less went over the side of the ship. But, I mean, you didn't go up to be seasick, you were seasick. Where you stood, so we were in there with all the sick. And
were you sick?
Oh, yeah. I don't think it was Ireland, but it wasn't. And we, I know it's a horrible subject, but we were sort of sick into our billy cans to try and get it emptied over the side, and we got half a chance in that. But, you know, half the time we couldn't see what you were doing anyway. And as I say, we must have been on that boat. And then 4 or 5 days. And all we had was this one tin of one biscuit and this one tin of thing. So that was probably the worst experience I had.
Did the seasickness wear off over the four?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that seemed to go off after about the first day. It seemed to calm down a bit then. And, but in a sense, because you were battened down, as it were, you lost all sort of sense of what the time was, or how long it was, or how it was. But that's an experience I... That's the only time in my life, I think, that I didn't care whether I lived or died, to tell you the history, so you can tell what... now I'm a fairly... happy sort of... happy-go-lucky sort of fellow I was. So you can tell we were pretty down on that boat.
So you went to Naples.
Then we landed in Naples. And the sight that I'll never forget, on the boat, at least a couple of blokes died while we went over. And we pulled into the harbour, and one early morning, I can remember seeing a rowboat, come over with two wooden coffins across it. That they brought to collect these two blokes. I don't know who they were, whether they were our blokes or somebody else's or not, but there were two blokes who had died on the trip over.
When you got ashore at Naples, how did the Italian population react to you?
Well, we were only on the dock side, so we didn't really see any of the docks, but we went from the sublime to the ridiculous in a way. Or from the, shall I say, the ridiculous to the sublime. Because when we got there, we were taken into this sort of camp place, washed, deloused, given tea.
How did they delouse you, sorry?
Well, you had a bath, and they put you put your clothes into a kind of an oven, where they steam it. They were supposed to steam the light out of it.
Did it work?
It worked sometimes. Sometimes I used to think they left it in long enough to hatch the blinking eggs out. But, yes, you know, to all intents and purposes it worked, and it was quite all right. As I say, we were given tea and that, which was, and a few cigarettes.
What about food? Because you'd been without for, on the crossing almost.
I think we had the usual common. And that seemed to be the standard. If you know. Then we went from there, they took us by train to a place called Vetrella.
Vetrella?
Vetrella. Vetrella, I think it was called. Vetrella.
And whereabouts was that, if you see what I mean?
Well, I'm not sure, but it was just outside Naples. And there again, this camp, I believe, had been built as a show camp.
Do you know its number? I think they had a system of numbers.
I don't know the number. The only number I can remember is that you do the one.
And what did it look like, this camp? What was the setup of the camp?
Well, the setup was wooden barracks and all laid out nicely, and two bunks and all that kind of thing.
And a fence round.
And a fence round.
And was it divided into different compounds, or was it just one big?
As far as I remember, it was one big compound. But and also as far as I remember, it wasn't a terribly big camp. You know what I mean? But later on, we went to a huge camp with thousands of, but this was, more than 100 or so, rather than than a huge camp. And there, we were looked after pretty well. We even had sheets on the beds, tea.
Instead of the Erstat's coffee?
Yeah, proper tea, you know, whether they got it out of the Red Cross bottles or not.
But the food didn't improve?
The food was about the same, you know, the cheese and the cod and the... that seemed to be standard right the way through.
Did you get any Red Cross parcels while you were there?
Not at that camp. No, not at that camp.
How did you amuse yourself at the camp? I mean, you know, of these first few, but...
We weren't there terribly long because we, as I said before, I think we left Tripoli about the end of November, and we left there, as far as I can remember, about January. So, you know, we were there a
couple of months.
But while we were there, well, we played cards and had a few quizzes and generally, you know, lounged about and chatted about that kind of thing. But nothing.
And the guards
were. We had I think it had been built as a show camp, so that when the Red Cross, when the people from the Red Cross came and everything, they could see that we were supposedly being looked after properly, and whether we were ashamed of the fact that we had such a rough journey out and that, I don't know. But, and I think the only reason we got moved out is because if I remember rightly, it was taken over for some Italians. And when we moved out, I think that was one of the reasons, because they wanted it to put some Italians in.
So where were you moved to?
From there, we went to a place called Udine.
Udine,
and I think it was called, I think it was PG-66.
And whereabouts is Udine?
Udine is in the north of Italy. Udine is in the north of Italy. And we were there, excuse me, we were there for quite a while at Udine. We got there about January.
43?
It would be January 43, yes. And we were there for quite a while, I should imagine, until early September. I think it was. We were there all that time, until about early September.
Now, was this another sort of barrack hut style camp?
This was a huge camp. There must have been 3,000 or 4,000 prisoners in the camp, and there were Aussies and New Zealanders and Indians and British. All in this camp.
Were you segregated by nationality?
Pretty well segregated, yes. We were segregated.
Was it by hut, or were there actually different compounds?
No, we were segregated by huts, not by compounds, because one of the things we did while we were there, we used to have more or less like test matches with you know, the New Zealanders who played the Aussies and the Aussies who played the British and the British played the...
So you had free movement amongst each other?
Free movement around.
But if you were British, you'd be in a British hut.
But this was the kind of prison camp that you see on the films, with the barbed wire all the way around, with the rolls of barbed wire in front, which was a no-go area, and the... guards in
towers
around the camps. That it was a real, what you might call a prisoner of war camp.
What were the huts like?
Well, first of all, we were in a stone building, and we're in there a fair while, I think a couple of months, and then we were moved out, and in that building there were three deer humps in it, you know, a real stack them up job. But after that we were moved out into the ordinary huts with 50 huts, 25 down, more or less 25 down each side. There were 12 bunks, 200 of them, so there were 24 down each side. And somebody, I see the 24, and in this case, I was one of the ICs because I was one of the senior NCOs.
As a sergeant.
As a sergeant. So I was IC these 24 guys.
And you had a separate bed, did you?
I had a separate bunk at the end of the...
Now, was there any heating?
Only a boiler in between, you know, when you put wood in it. One of these...
In the middle of the hut?
In the middle of the hut.
And was there sufficient fuel?
By and large, yes, I think by and large, we used wood. It was just wood.
And they supplied you with that?
And we were supplied with that.
Were you, as you were in charge, were you responsible for keeping the hut clean?
I was responsible for all the blokes, keeping the hut clean, dishing out the Red Cross passes, because there we got Red Cross passes, and chiefly it was one by two and two, by and large, Also, I dished the food out for 24 guys as well. I had they used to bring billy cans up with a mug on the end of a stick, and I would dish out the food and dish out the cobs.
Did that cause any disputes, that? Because food can be close to people's hearts, you know.
Well, we did it on the same basis that we did work before. You worked on a rota system, so you got one mug full of your soup and rice a day, and then you left over, that you got your extra bit. But you took it in turns. So, you know, if they were a bit generous one day, probably five or six of you got a bit extra that day, but you didn't get it the next day, you shouldn't modify it.
And it was your job to administer that?
It was my job to administer that. While we're in that camp, I was taught to play bridge.
I'll come back to that.
Yeah,
just looking
sure.
at this internal sort yeah. of control yeah. business, you were in charge of your hut.
That's right.
You were in charge of the men in it. Was there any trouble with any of the men? I mean, were they all able to cope with prisoner of war life?
By and large, I didn't have any trouble with mine. I think one or two got a bit fed up and had to go to the sick wards and that kind of thing. But
you mean depressed?
Depressed and that sort of thing, you know. But with the lot I had, we were very good. And another responsibility was that, sometimes, every day, you had to march past, and they carried you off. You would do a trade, quite teaching, because they, you know, to see that you were all there. And then, sometimes, they'd have a turnout in the middle of the night, sort of thing. And so, it was my job to see that my 24 guys were there, as it were.
48 or 24?
24, because there was another lad had the 12 bunks, 24 guys, one at the end on that side. 12 bunks,
sorry.
24 guys, one at the end on that side.
You had to make sure they were all there then?
Well, yeah, I think that was to try and make us responsible, you know, because of the smaller units, and I suppose it's always easier to control that now, I don't know. That's how it
ran. And you ran the internal economy of the hut. You would tell them, you just tell people to clean it.
Oh, yes.
But on a rota basis.
Well, you more or less had to. The only thing we did, they provided us with rooms, and we took it in turns to sweep the place out.
And would you do that as well?
Oh, well.
You'd take your turn.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Now, you were in charge of half the hut.
That's right.
Would somebody else be? Was there anyone in charge of the whole hut? In charge of
no,
you?
No.
So you were just half the hut. What about in the camp generally? Who was IC of the camp as internally?
There was an idea. Oh yeah, excuse me. That it was an Aussie sergeant major that was the overall local charge. Who did the talking to the commandant and all that kind of thing?
Would he be in charge of the whole camp then?
Yes.
And would there be another IC British POWs as well, or would the Aussie Aussie deal with you?
Not that I know of. As far as I know, he was the liaison with the camp. He dealt with them all on the.
So you'd go to him.
That's right.
There was no intermediary on the British side.
Not the time we were now, anyway. Not the times we were now. We were allocated our tasks, we did that. He was the bloke that negotiated with him. And for instance, as I recall, the Red Cross parcels came in sealed wagons. And the somebody had to go down while the wagons were unsealed and the parcels brought to the camp. And he was the guy that did that. He might have had some goodies, but I don't know about that. Because it's such a big camp that you couldn't know all of them.
So you'd be allotted your hut share or your half hut share?
That's right.
And then you dole it out.
Well, I shared with the other IC.
You shared with him, and then you divide yours in between the bunks, yeah. So to speak.
You talked about was there any trouble. There was trouble. We had the only time we had any trouble was once when one lad pinched some of another person's parcel. And they found him out, and they took revenge, not so. They punished him by starting him at one end of the hut and making him go down the other end of the hut, and everybody had a go at him.
What with?
All the way down. Thumping him.
Hard?
Oh, well, he had to go to hospital.
What sort of damage had he suffered?
Well, black eye, bruises, that kind of thing.
So they weren't just thumps to the body? There
no, it was really worked over.
Now, who organised that? Was that the person who had
that?
Or did you and the IC organise?
I didn't organise him. I sort of came in on it, as it were. You know what I mean? I think the lads had said, like.
So it wasn't so much you and the other person in charge.
They'd organised that. No.
It was the
lads themselves. It was a kangaroo court, whatever you like to call it. But they really. And to this day, I can remember his name. His name was Goodfella. And it stuck in my mind, that did. Because he was the one that got done over.
Did you approve of that sort of behaviour?
Well. Approve might not be the word. I went along with it because the one thing that, and I think you mentioned this yourself, the one thing that you prized amongst everything else was your food, because you didn't get enough really to, you know, to be able to throw it around, as it were. And when you were only getting really one meal a day, it wasn't British, if you like, to steal other people.
Was this the only case of stealing you were aware of?
That I knew of. Yes, it was.
Now, the parcels that you got, what was in the Red Cross parcels?
What was in the parcels?
at that time?
As far as I can remember, there was a tin of Klim.
Klim?
Klim, that's dried milk. Klim is milk spelled backwards. And it was called Klim. And it was a tin of dried milk. There was a tea, coffee, chocolate, biscuits, corned beef, like a spam roll thing. I think there was some sugar in it. And a jar of jam or marmalade.
So
that's about, they were quite, but don't forget, we've got the last two all week.
So you got half a box a week?
We got one of them. In other words, your one tin of corned beef was between two of you. And that's at the last two all week.
Was there much bartering done?
Yes, there was a hell of a lot of bartering because we used to get cigarettes.
Was that with the Red Cross or was that?
Well, we got some with the Red Cross for a start, but then while we were there, there was a certain number of parcels sent from home, and people used to say, although I didn't smoke, my folks used to send me cigarettes because that was the cigarettes was the currency in the camp.
And they knew that. They'd enough nouse to work it out.
That's right. And apart from the fact that I think we probably told them anyway in the road home, and asked for cigarettes, and they used to send them.
And what? So you again used, as you described before, you used the cigarettes as a bartering.
They were, yeah.
To get food.
Sort of about five cigarettes was a cob, something like that. And if you wanted to, if somebody was selling the chocolate out of their Red Cross parcel, that was so many cigarettes. I can't remember it.
It sounds from that, though, as if the rate of exchange was against the cigarette smoker. I mean, for relative usefulness.
Oh, yes. Oh, right. The cigarette smoker, if you like, got the more end of the deal. But it was amazing how many people would sell their food for cigarettes. It's quite
Were you ever tempted to start?
Smoking, no. I was very fortunate in that sense. I never did. Something that never appealed to me.
And what was it you most liked to get with your cigarettes?
Well, anything, really.
You weren't fussy?
I wasn't fussy as long as it was food, because I've always liked the food. And anything that you can get, chocolate or biscuits, extra corned beef or anything like that.
What else would you get sent from home in parcels? You know, this from home, not the Red Cross.
Well, I never had anything other than cigarettes. Whether they were allowed to send clothes or anything like that, I'm not sure. But what we did discover, when I finally got home, was that somebody somewhere along the line must have been on the make or on the figure, because my folks told me they more or less send a parcel every month. But I must have got two while I was there, sort of thing. So somebody somewhere, whether it was the Italians or the British or the others within the camp, or whether they were at it between them, I don't know. But all the things, and my brother-in-law and people I've spoke to since discovering that.
How many cigarettes would you get sent in a parcel?
About 200.
And you only got two deliveries from home?
As far as I can remember, it must have been about two.
Was there a similar missing of things from the Red Cross parcels? Was either from complete parcels or
were they? Well, you see, for all we knew, they could have been sending us a parcel each. But we ended up getting one between two.
Were the parcels you got always
sealed?
Contact, you know,
yes,
intact?
Yes, always intact.